You're listening to Truth To You Radio with Jono on truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org, also available on iTunes. And g'day wherever you may be around the world. And thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Light of the Prophets with Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, Yoel.
You too.
How you going, my friend?
Baking.
it's summer and you're in the desert and you're baking away. Hey, I've got a couple of comments from some people. This was left by Stephen on Facebook. He said, thank you, guys. Anthony also said, Jono, thank you so much for what you do, man. I look forward to both Light of the Prophets and Torah Pearls Weekly. Thank you, Anthony and Stephen. And Cindy said on Facebook, I do believe, I love these, in reference to the Light of the Prophets, along with the Torah Pearls, Torah Rabbah, and keep the information flowing. It's greatly appreciated. Blessings to you all for the work you do to further the kingdom of Yehovah. Well, thank you, Cindy and Anthony and Stephen. We love getting comments. Really do appreciate that. But today we're kicking off from Judges chapter 8, verse 30. And this, of course, is the story of Yoel. Who is this?
Story of Avimelech. One of the most horrible stories ever. There's several very bad stories. This is one of the more difficult ones. One of the main things here is there's some level of criticism here about certain issues. There's a lot of politics going on in this chapter as well. It's kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. It's really an offshot from the story of Gideon. It's one chapter, but it kind of gives you insight of what was going on, politics, cultural politics in between different groups. Gives you an insight of how things were conducted more or less at the time. And some researchers consider this to be an added chapter that's not really part of the flow of the story, but because it's related to one of the original judges, then they continued the story because it actually is connected. And the connection is very, very clear. We mentioned that last time, that Avimelech can mean my father is king. I also looked at another meaning I found lately, which means Avi really actually means Avi is Gideon, he is king. That's one thing that we said. And then Avi is another way of saying my God is king. And it might be, there's a game here with his name, that his father meant it to refer to God as being my God is king. He is sovereign. And it had to do with the whole question of people turning to him saying, can you please be king over us? And he decided to use a name that meant, no, our God is king. And then his son used the name on the other end, basically saying, my father is king, therefore I am king as well, which would be also an explanation of why he did what he did. He wanted to be king. End of story.
And so there is that the speculation, which we mentioned last week as well. Did Gideon, in the latter half of his life, did he fancy himself as some kind of a king at least? And the speculation does come from naming his son Avimelech. But putting that aside, it certainly seems that Avimelech fancied himself as a king. And I guess it's fair to say that he was Israel's first king, but he's not really a king, though, is he? I mean, we're going to get into that.
But there's a problem here, because it says here in verse 29, Yehobar, son of Joash, went and sat in his house. He doesn't say he went to reign over Israel. He just went back home. So he wasn't actually interested in being king. But the prosperity of his life was pretty serious. For example, it says that Gideon had 70 sons who actually were his actual sons. Yotzei Yericho basically means the one who came out from his thigh, which basically all know what that means. Mm-hmm. And he had many wives, which is a sign of kingship. Because, for example, it says in Deuteronomy, the king is not allowed to have many wives, but Lo yirbelo nashim, you shouldn't have multitude of wives, but kings essentially had many wives as well. And there's also an issue here of the 70. 70 not necessarily means that he actually literally had 70, but we usually say, if there's a number like this, then we prefer to say it is literally like this. But the idea is also a sign of prosperity. 70, anything which is a multiplication of 7, 70, again, we spoke about the 7 being some kind of like an absolute number. Yes. I was actually asked a question regarding the 7 altars that we had with Bilam, and I basically the idea is that the 7 is some kind of an absolute number with some kind of appeasing meaning. It's kind of tricky. I actually tried to sit down and read information about this, and it wasn't 100% clear, because what the symbols of certain things aren't really clear to us. But some people say 70 is really call it topological.
Because that's an interesting thing that you say in regards to Balaam, because it seems like there's some sort of God-given approval for the sacrifices that he's making, the seven altars, and he's got the offerings, and he does that, and then Yehovah meets with him, and it seems like he has knowledge of what is expected, but that's speculation. It's not explicitly in the text, but it is very interesting.
I actually called it as if people are pressing, as if he's pressing some kind of buttons. That's one of the ideas of witchcraft. I mean, he was a wizard or a warlock or whatever you want to call that. He was a magician. Though he recognized the idea that really the source of all power and everything in the world is his God, which he specifically refers to by the name, at least in our text, he knew where it comes from. He knew what it is, but he was manipulating it a different way. He wasn't a prophet in the way that, for example, Moses was, but he was extremely powerful, even to a point where the Midrash says that he was the powerful equivalent of Moses. And there's issues there with basically how, you know, what exactly he's doing. So one of the things I always said was that he's pushing buttons, and that's how witchcraft works. You learn to channel certain things. And the difference in between, for example, a prophet who does a miracle and a warlock or whatever it would be, is that a person who's a warlock basically will not always 100% work, because he's trying to channel that whatever it is, energy, whatever you want to call it. You know, it's going to start sounding like Harry Potter, but I understand that it was some kind of a debate regarding Harry Potter,
and that's always a hot debate. That one won't go away for some time, I think, but.
I actually do want to share my opinion about Harry Potter, by the way. Can
go
I?
On.
Is it okay to
go
do that?
On,
is,
sure.
So my opinion about Harry Potter is, first of all, I've never read any of the books, and I don't allow my children to read the books either.
And
the thing is as follows. Yes, it's only a story. Yes, it's not really magic or anything like that. But it's when you read a book, I mean, for example, the movies... It's like a movie. You know, remember I mentioned this whole thing about, are you allowed to go watch, I don't know, The Avengers, because it has a character there called Thor, which happens to be a Nordic deity.
Certainly,
you know, that's a question. But when it comes to the Harry Potter movies, again, you know, it might probably might not be a problem. I don't think it's that terrible to watch the movie. I think the movies were terrible, but that's besides the point. but won't you have a book... And the book presents a certain aspect of certain ideas. It becomes problematic, because when you read a book, it's not going to be 2 hours in the cinema or 3 hours in the cinema. You're actually going to be involved in it for maybe a month. And if you're a child, it might be even 6 months. And the child is going to be reading this book every day, and it becomes part of their culture. And that's where I see the problem. It's not necessarily the idea that there's a story where the storyline is based on some magic and stuff like that. It's the fact that the child is heavily involved at one point in the whole idea, in the whole concept. It becomes part of their culture. And I think this is the real problem.
I would agree with that.
The reason I say this is because for example, I have relatives who read these books. And I have a relative who happens to be a child. And they read the book, and it just... could see this whole thing, like everything is Harry Potter, everything, and it's I think it's a problem. I don't like the whole idea of being heavily involved with this stuff, because it looks it's our culture. You know, what we do in our everyday life is actually our culture, and if we read this book every day or even once a week, we're turning it into our culture. We're bringing it into our houses. And for example, it says in Deuteronomy, don't bring anything which is forbidden to your house. And there's
lest you be cursed like the thing. That's the end of chapter 7 of Deuteronomy.
Exactly. And it's referring there specifically to idolatry. And I think, you know, if we think about it, witchcraft and idolatry are linked to one another. Strongly linked to one another, to be very blunt.
I would agree.
Okay. I have to bring a towel to wipe the sweat. Just
you can get a towel to wipe the sweat. While you do that, I'm going to start reading to let everyone know we are in chapter 8, verse 30. It begins like this. Gideon had 70 sons who were his own offspring, for he had many wives, and his concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son, whose name he called Abimelech. We know that much. Now, Gideon, the son of Joash, died at a good old age and was buried in the tomb of Joash, his father, in Ophrah, in Abiezrites. Is that right? Abiezrites?
Abiezrites, yeah. By the way, concubines, that's an interesting subject by itself. What and, exactly? Well,
she's later described as a female servant, I think. But what is a concubine as opposed to a wife?
So one of the differences of a concubine and a wife, and we don't have too many examples in our history as a people of concubines, but there are concubines. King Solomon had concubines, mm-hmm. but we don't have too many examples of them in the Bible. Mm-hmm. But one of the things about concubines is that they don't have the rights of a wife. In the mm-hmm. rabbinic tradition, they say one of the differences is that she doesn't have a ketubah. Ketubah is this agreement in between a husband and wife. He divorces her, he gives a certain amount of money and stuff like that. But it's actually not biblical. So we have to look at what is the origins of the concept of a pilegish. The pilegish is a concubine. So they say the whole idea of a pilegish is probably cases of women that could not get married. They come from a miserable family, for example, not a very good family. The family has no money, whatever it is. So there's an agreement that she kind of marries this person, and it really starts raising questions of this concept of what exactly is marriage. Is marriage, there's debates about, is marriage by living together in the same house, is that enough for marriage? Is marriage decided according to consummation of the marriage? And I would say that it's probably not the consummation itself. It's probably the fact that they're living together. Obviously, if people are living together, they also consummate the marriage itself, but essentially, it's probably being a wife. The main thing is to be living with the husband in a house that belongs to the husband and being under his wing, meaning he provides for her, etc., etc., etc. We have in Exodus 22 when it talks about if a person sells his daughter as a female slave, or it's not really even a slave, it's an ama, and if he decides to give her to his son and he marries her, there's three things he has to do for her. Which is she'erak sutav onata, she'erai, from the word she'er, which means food. She'er is another word in the Bible for flesh, and it's used in different ways. Here it's used as meat, food. It can also be used as she'er basar, the remnants of flesh, meaning relatives. And it says means clothing, covering. He makes sure she has clothing. Ve'onata has to do, usually explained as being the sexual act. And when it comes to a concubine, he doesn't owe her anything. He meets up with her every once in a while. She doesn't live in his house. He doesn't have to provide for her. But one of the differences is that she can have children from him. There is a man in her life, which means there is probably some level of protection. If she needs to be protected from someone, she can go to him and say, please protect me, put me under your wing. But he doesn't owe her anything. Mm-hmm. There actually are no laws regarding concubines, which is a very, very interesting thing. Why aren't there any? If there is such a reality, why aren't there any rules when it comes to concubines? And it could be because the Bible's, again, the Torah is written in a cultural reality, and it's not giving you all the details. It sometimes assumes that, you're supposed to know what this means.
So, well, in any case, he has a concubine who was in Shechem, and that's a key detail.
She might have been a Canaanite, by the way.
Sure. And it says
which is very important for the story.
Now, by the way, does Gideon, do we know where his tomb is today?
Not that I know of. Okay. I've never heard of the tomb of Gideon, but it's probably somewhere in the part of section, somewhere in the area called Benjamin. There's a district in Israel, which is Judea and Samaria. So it's actually really Judea, Samaria, and Benjamin. This is the one thing people don't really realize. It's Judea and Samaria, and what's called Samaria, there's an area actually called the area of Benjamin. And it actually covers also areas that belong to Ephraim and Menashe and Judah, but it's just a new area that they just decided to, It's kind of funny as if someone walked up with a marker and went like, this area is going to be called Benjamin. He just squiggled over with some green line or something. He's like, we're going to call this Benjamin. This is going to be called Samaria. This is going to be called Judea. And it's like, not necessarily really, the areas are not really what they're supposed to be, but, that's where it is.
Now, just while we're talking about that, and I'm just jumping off the subject for a second, you're in the desert now. You're in Judea, right?
I am in the Judean desert, basically.
Beautiful.
The center part of the Judean desert. Actually, if you get hop on a, we usually call it a small tractor here in Israel. It's not really a tractor. It's like a half tractor, half motorcycle. I can't remember what they're called in English.
Oh, quad bike.
I'll take your word for it. And if you jump on one of those, you can actually be in the Dead Sea. Like, it's like an hour away from here.
Cool.
And If you walk, it'll take you a couple of hours, but it's not that far away. And I actually have friends who've done it. So it's
nice. So the desert of Judea.
I'm like the people of Qumran now.
Right. Out in the desert, hiding scrolls in caves. Okay, so it was, this is verse 33, so it was as soon as Gideon was dead that the children of Israel played the harlot with the Baals and made Baal Brit their god. Now, Baal Brit, Yoel, what does that mean?
So Baal Brit, so Baal is the classic name of the pagan god Baal. So there were many different types of Baals. Baal Zvov, Baal this, Baal that. And here Baal Brit, so Brit means covenant. So it's a very, very strange name. There's no record of any type of Baal called Baal Brit. And this is why commentators basically say we have no idea what this thing is.
Is it possible, but, can I ask you, is it possible that they are referring to the God or the Master or the Lord of the Covenant? Because we see in a few more verses down the track, I think it's in verse 46, that this God is referred to as El Brit as well. It says, now when the men of the tower of Shechem heard about it.
Yeah, Beit El Brit. Well, you have to remember Baal and El. Oh, so El goes like this. The Canaanite pantheon is that it was the father god El, which was like the first god, and he has children called Baal and everything. So, but that's an interesting point. Maybe, they're confusing the god of Israel with Baal, and they're just doing something in between. They recognize, okay, Baal and our ancestral god is really the same thing, so we're just calling him Baal, but we're calling him also Brit because of the covenant we have with him. Mm-hmm. And you might be right on that one. You might be right, because there's actually no, as far as I know, no record of a Baal called Baal Brit, unless this is some kind of Israelite hybrid.
Sure. This is my point, because if that is the case, and we can't be certain, obviously, but if that is the case, then here is another example of the golden calf, right?
Not necessarily golden calf, but the concept of golden calf.
Concept,
we're confusing things with other things. So this is the thing that Torah was warning about all the time, is that don't do anything outside of the rules I gave you, because if you start doing that, you're going to start confusing this with that, and you're going to start inventing new things. And you know, I meet people who are. You know, they're Jewish and they believe in the God of Israel, but they're very big on Buddhism, and they have started having difficulty separating Buddhism from Judaism and the Buddhism from Torah, and they basically start saying, you know, or they take Hinduism, and if you ever read the writings of Patanjali, you notice that there are elements there which of one God. It's kind of interesting. The Hindus essentially really believe only in one God, but it's almost like a philosophical God. And if you open up the Patanjali, the Patanjali Sutra, you actually find there are interesting quotes where he kind of talks as like very similar to what Maimonides says. So if you take that and you start with Torah, you start confusing things. This is why Torah says, don't add, don't reduce, just do exactly what I said. And there's a reason for it. And this is a sign of what can happen. And it's not only that, you know, there's even elements today inside Judaism that people start confusing things. And they start, you know, playing around with meaning of things. So you know, this is why Torah really repeats it twice. You know, don't add, don't reduce, just keep it as it is. Don't muck around, because we can develop into things like this. We can just develop a golden calf. We can develop the golden calves of Yerubal. Of Yerubam. We can develop what we have here, which is I think we're actually right about this one, to tell you the truth. The more I think about it, it sounds more and more reasonable. Because if there is no Canaanite record, therefore, it's probably a hybrid, and this is why there's no record.
It's interesting. So, if it is the case, it says that they played the harlot. So, the mixing of the true faith with other pagan faiths or whatever it may be, clearly God sees that as playing the harlot. In any case, they played the harlot with the Baals and made Baal Brit their god. Thus, the children of Israel did not remember Yehovah their God, who had delivered them from the hand of all their enemies on every side, nor did they show kindness to the house of Yerubbaal, Gideon, in accordance with the good he had done for Israel.
This is actually already a hint to what's about to happen, because he was a leader, and then Avimelech does what he does, and he actually had support from people. And you know, they go out and they murder the entire family. It's like, how, you know, if there's one son who says, "Let me be king," and kill off the rest of my family. It must have been someone who stands up and says, this doesn't make sense. Your father, we respect him, and therefore we respect the entire family. Why would we should we listen to you? So this is like they're telling you this entire chapter actually is some kind of like a lesson being taught about a whole bunch of stuff. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of like side notes here and there. They did this, they did that, you know, and they're hinting to a whole bunch of things. And I will point out something very, very important. Avimelech is a complete contradiction of his father. Yes. He imitates things from his father, but he does also completely contradicting things from his father. He takes the same idea his father did, but did the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. And I actually want to list them before we even continue reading. So his father didn't want to be king. He actually went to become king. That's one, yes. one difference.
True.
They both took money, but the purpose of taking the money was different. Gideon took the money to create a symbol commemoration of the triumph of the God of Israel. Remember, we've said there were no swords, so mm-hmm. they considered to be a triumph of God, the God of Israel, over the enemies. He took money to murder the family.
And incidentally, that amount of money was 70 shekels of silver.
Exactly mm-hmm. the same amount of money. His father was supported by the people of Israel. He is probably supported by Canaanites. Mm-hmm. It's another difference. His father was supported by the God of Israel. He's supported by money from the house of idolatry. So he's supported by idolatry. Mm-hmm. And the last one, this is the main thing. His father, if you remember, we said his father took revenge for the murder of members of family. Mm-hmm. We mentioned that when he's asked by the princes or the kings of Midian, you know, they said, who are these people you murdered? And they said, they looked like you, therefore we understand that they were relatives.
Oh, yes.
He did the exact opposite. He murdered his relatives.
True. Very
good point. This is the big one.
Mm. And it is. So what happens is basically he went to the men of Shechem and he said, hey, listen, guys, I'm one of you, right? My mother, she's one of you. And I also happen to be I'm one of the descendants of Gideon. And so, listen, if you appoint me, we'll knock off these other guys, my brothers, and I will be ruler over everyone and we'll all be happy, right? And they thought, well, this is a pretty good deal. Let's do that. Here's 70 shekels. Let's make it happen. And so they did put to the sword on one stone. I believe it says in verse 5, he went to his father's house at Ophrah, killed his brothers, the 70 sons of Yerubbaal, Baal, on the stone, but Jotham the youngest...
Jotham
the youngest of Yerubbaal was left because he hid himself. That's a good idea. And all the men of Shechem gathered together.
Here's another interesting parallel between him and his father.
Go on.
When we went, people remember we went to the Mount of Eval to see the Joshua altar, and there was a whole discussion there regarding the altar itself. And one of the things that was claimed there is that a large slab of rock can also be an altar. Mm-hmm. And essentially, in the end, when they discovered the actual altar itself, they said it wasn't it. But there was a scholar, an archaeologist, who came to the land somewhere in the late 1800s or early 1900s and identified the slab of rock as being the altar. Now, the verse here says something very interesting. It says that he killed them on one rock, on one stone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, probably what it means is that this is either was an execution stone, or that it means in one go, because, for example, you can kill two birds with one stone, right? Sure. Same idea here. It's as if they're saying the idea of killing them in one swoop, in one go, and one of them was able to run away. The other possibility is that there was actually an execution rock there, which he used to execute them.
Mm-hmm.
And this was something, you know, it wasn't just attacking. He just went systematically and executed each one of them, which makes it even worse. It's a form of sadism, and the idea is that his father built an altar, and his father built an altar for God of Israel. He built an altar for the shedding of the blood of his family.
Mm-hmm.
That's another kind of gruesome parallel. Again, if you notice, we're always mentioning the fact that this book is full of gruesome activity.
It is gruesome. There's no doubt about it.
And it's pointed out just to show the anarchy that was going on at the time. People were just violent. There was no structure.
Mm-hmm.
But it brings us here to an interesting dilemma. What is the purpose of Jotham's parable? What is the point of what he's trying to say here? And there are different opinions. So I think I'll present the different opinions, and each person can decide whatever they want. But there's an opinion that says he's just, you know, cursing them. He's telling a story to intrigue them, and then he gives the curse. Mm-hmm. He's trying to just tell them an idea. Like you know, because the parallel here is not 100%, because they only turned to his father. They then turned to three different people and then reached Avimelech. They just turned to his father, mm-hmm. and then turned to Avimelech to be king. And we have the three different plants here. We have it starts off with an olive tree. So olive tree produces olive oil, which mm-hmm. is part of what was used to anoint kings. Okay, this is why he first of all uses the olive tree, the issue of anointing, and then he turns over. What's the next one? He turns over to the fig tree. Now figs are just yummy, by the way.
Yeah,
never had a fig. Do it. And then he talks about the vine. Mm. Now, what is the logic of exactly why he chose this, why he chose that? The olive tree, I think, is very clear. The fig tree, probably because it's a very big tree, maybe the idea, because he's trying to compare it to the atad, to this shrub of sorts. Mm-hmm. And you take the olive tree, and there's the olive oil for the anointing. You take the fig tree, it's a very big tree, it's kind of wide. You can sit under its shade. It's pretty cool, you know, and there's a very, very good and nutritious fruit. And then, so that's the issue of, you know, the parallel to the shrub, which I can't even remember what's called in English. But what is it called in English, by the way?
I've got a bramble here, which is kind of a thorny shrub, right?
Yeah, so a bramble, that's probably it. And, you know, so the bramble is small. There's no shade, nothing. It doesn't produce any fruit. And on the other hand, the fig tree is kind of big, and you know, there's a lot of shade. You can even climb on it. It's a very comfortable tree to climb. Mm. And then you have the vine, which is just a very, very important tree, if it's even a tree. But it's a very important tree in this area, in this region, with a lot of important things. You know, wine being a very important drink at the time. You know, there's always this question, are you allowed to drink alcohol? And the answer is yes. People actually drank alcohol on an everyday basis. This is the type of wine they drank was probably less alcoholic. But we find it in many places where characters in the Bible, for example, when King David runs away from Absalom, the man who brings him food and drink, he brings him wine to drink.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, it's you're running away from your son. Everything is bad. Here's some alcohol. You know, sure. What's the point?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing that you bring up, because it actually says, at least in the English here in verse 13, it says, but the vine said to them, should I cease my new wine, which cheers both God and man? That's interesting. It seems to cheer God, at least in the eyes of Yotam.
So the question is what he means, cheers God. I mean, you have to remember wine was used on the altar as well. So it's part of the idea of being part of the sacrifice, which everything together turns into a reach nichoach, a pleasant smell to God. So it's also part of that. But it could be that Elohim here also means rulers or whatever it would be. But again, the parallel won't be logical if it means ruler and man. So what's the point of saying man? You should say ruler and commoner. So it probably actually doesn't mean God. Mm-hmm. But the parallel here is that this is a fruitful tree. This is a very wonderful tree. And then we have this shrub. So he's actually turning to them and saying, you know, if the big mighty ones turned you down, why are you turning to the shrub who doesn't even come from a good family? His mother was a concubine. Mm-hmm. He's murderous. He's just horrible person. You know, if my father Gideon said to you, no, why are you turning to this guy? What's the point? Mm-hmm. What he's trying to tell. There is another also an opinion that says that this is what's called this is an anti-monarchy idea. But I have trouble accepting this idea. They're trying to basically say, you know, Jotham was really saying, you know, forget about monarchy. We don't need a king. And that was what Yotam was trying to say. I don't really see that in the text. And I have another reason why it doesn't make sense, because also we have to remember that the books were edited. So if there was editing of the book, someone had a purpose in writing these things out. And the book repeatedly says there is no king in Israel, basically saying there's no order. We need a king. We need order in this place. And the story is also used to show you this is what happens when you have the wrong king.
Can I offer the way that I understood it? And of course, just letting everyone know, of course, we're talking from verse 7 to verse 15. is what Yotam said from the top of Mount Gerizim. He lifted his voice and cried out, and he said this to them. And it seems to me to be saying, and let me know what you think about this, it seems to me to be saying, look, all of my other brothers and I, we had our purposes, we had things that we were doing that we were good at. Why would we leave those things to go and rule over you? We were pleased with the things that we were doing, and it was pleasing others. And that was our thing. We had no grand ambitions to rule over you. It's not as if we wanted to stop what we were doing to go and do this. And yet you guys have now turned to the thorn bush, if you like. I mean, come on, what are you talking about? This is ridiculous.
I like that. That also works. Makes sense.
That's the way I understood it when I read it. And so, and it says, now this is the, and I do think that he's making that point, but obviously in the final verses, he's pronouncing a curse, it would certainly seem. And he says, then all the trees said to the bramble, you come and reign over us. And the bramble said to the trees, if in truth you anoint me as king over you, then come and take shelter in my shade. But if not, let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon. And he goes on to sort of unpack what he's saying in regards to what appears to be a curse that he pronounces over them. Shall I read that?
Yeah, I'll read it.
Okay. Hey, before I do, can I ask you something about verse 6? Can we just jump back to verse 6 for a second?
Okay, let's jump back. And you, well, and you said this is going to be a quick one.
It's not. And all the men of Shechem gathered together, all at Bet Milo, and they went and made Abimelech king beside the terebinth tree at the pillar that was in Shechem. Now, this location, the terebinth tree at the pillar that was in Shechem.
There's a lot of opinion. I actually wanted to mention this when I forgot, so it's a good thing you went back to that one. If you ever look into the concept, I mean, there's quite a few of them. I'm quite surprised how many there actually are in the area of Shechem. There are these holy trees,
mm-hmm.
and these holy trees in many cases have pillars next to them because the pillars represent certain things. You have to remember also that erecting a pillar, you know, we have the story with Jacob. He erects something like a pillar, a holy place in Beit El, which was part of, by the way, part of the tour that I did together with Keith. Mm-hmm. Hopefully the videos will come out soon, and waiting for those videos.
Yeah.
So it actually says here that they made him king. Elim. Elim here in this case it means near. Mm-hmm. Elon Mutzav. So Elon Mutzav. These two words are connected to one another, but it's a very, very strange name. And I decided in the end to say that this means this is an oak tree with a mutzav, something which is erected next to it, because the root of mutzav is natzav or nitzav, which means something which is standing erected. So right. It probably means a tree with a pillar. This was some kind of like a small temple or something like that. And by the way, if you remember, we spoke about some kind of tree in Joshua. Remember the end of Joshua,
we spoke about
some kind of tree. This might be the exact same tree. This might be the exact same tree. And there was some kind of like temple kind of thing going on there, something which is not supposed to be, but it was there anyhow.
Sure. And so that's where it was going. And this is in Shechem, obviously, and this is Joshua 24, verse 25. I'll just read it quickly. So Joshua made a covenant with the people that day and made for them a statute and an ordinance in Shechem. Then Joshua wrote all these words in the book of the law of God, and he took a large stone, set it up there under the oak that was by the sanctuary of Yehovah. And so obviously they've got the tabernacle set up there in Shechem. He's set up the stone, the pillar, if you like, and it's under the oak tree that was by the sanctuary. So this, I'm kind of thinking it's probably the same place. I mean, what better place to sort of anoint a king?
It may be. I really don't know what to tell you. It's the period itself was very confusing, but it might be the same one. It might be someone else. If you remember, this is an interesting question, and we have to ask ourselves, what is the population of Shem? Who is actually living there? And they might be Canaanites.
Whatever the population is, it's about to get a lot less.
Yeah, obviously it's about to get a lot less, but there's a question here. You know, are these Canaanites? Are these Israelites? Are these some kind of mixed multitude? It is actually not clear to me.
Yeah, no, it's not specific. Well, in any case, let's unpack this curse.
But before we do that, by the way, just remember that later on in the Book of Kings, Shechem becomes a place where kings are anointed, by the way. Shem is a very, 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 very important city.
No, that's interesting. Okay. Want to speculate over a little more. Be interested in comments from the listeners on that one. From verse 16, now therefore, if you have acted in truth, so this is Yotam continuing on after he's told his, it's kind of like a parable, I guess, if you like. Now therefore, if you have acted in truth and sincerity in making Abimelech king, and if you have dealt well with Yerubbaal and his house and have done to him as he deserves, for my father fought for you, risked his life and delivered you out of the hand of Midian, but you have risen up against my father's house this day and killed 70 sons on the stone and made Abimelech king, Abimelech the son of his female servant, and there's the reference to the female servant, also concubine a little earlier on.
The reason of Ben Amato is he's mocking, probably mocking him. That's why he's using that word. He comes from a real wife. He's a son of a Pelegish, of a concubine. He's just putting him down, saying he's a son of a slave.
He's rubbing it in.
He's rubbing it in. Exactly. It's exactly what he's doing.
King over the men of Shechem, because he is your brother. If then you have acted in truth and sincerity with Yerubbaal, with his house this day, then rejoice in Abimelech, and let him also rejoice in you. But, verse 20, if not, let fire come out of Abimelech and devour the men of Shechem and Bet Milo, and let fire come out from the men of Shechem and from Bet Milo and devour Abimelech. And Yotam ran away and fled, and he went to Beer. That's a place that sounds all right. And dwelt there.
Be'era.
No, it says Beer. What are you talking about?
Well, it's Be'era. Well, no, sometimes the S sound in the Hebrew is translated as an E, but there's also, I think in the Septuagint, they actually appear as Be'er or something like that. The Septuagint has a slightly different tradition of reading.
I read that and I thought, hey, there's a place worth visiting when I come to Israel.
Beer.
Beer. That's where he went to lay low and dwelt there for fear of Abimelech, his brother, which is fair enough, I guess.
By the way, the whole thing of standing on the top of Mount Gerizim, if you stand on top of Mount Gerizim and yell down to Shechem, no one can hear you, to be very, very blunt. What he probably means is he stood in a very high place that he kept the distance, but they could still hear him, but he was in a high place that if they try to run up to get a hold of him, he still has, he has a distance that they have to cover. Exactly. He has a good head start before they can actually get a hold of him. Because, again, he's in danger. His entire family was just murdered.
You know what? You know what I think? Hey, by the way, I mean, if you have some kind of rock formation behind you, some sort of concave rock formation behind you, then you're able to project your voice down towards that direction. True. It's possible that you may, based on that, maybe you can find out where he was. I mean, rocks of that sort of size don't disappear quickly.
Yeah, the problem is like he can't really go and do a survey. It's kind of dangerous. But if the archaeologists are correct when it comes to the issue of the original location of Shechem, which would be what's called Tel Balata, which is this place, which is one of the most cramped places I think in the world. And you stand on the top of Mount Gerizim. We're not on the top of Mount Gerizim, but there's an area you can stand there. Mm-hmm. And if there's no wind, if you shout down, you're relatively high up, and it's a very slopey area. It's almost 90 degrees there, maybe more like 75 degrees. If you yell out down, they're not that far away from you. That might be the place where he stood. It's quite possible. I've stood there many, many times. It's not on the peak of Mount Gerizim. It's lower, but it's relatively high in the area. And you can actually stand there. And if Tel Balata is the actual original Shechem, then if you yell down, it actually probably works when I think about it.
Very interesting. Verse 22. Now, 22 and 23, boy, do I have some questions for you. After Abimelech had reigned over Israel 3 years, God sent, Yoel,
Your one says reigned. My one is, it doesn't say Malach, it says Vayasar, which is from the word Srara, which means to rule with an iron fist.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So he didn't just reign. He was almost suggesting he was a tyrant over Israel for 3 years. Is that fair?
Probably. What does it mean, Israel? He didn't reign over the entire people of Israel. He probably reigned on certain groups that accepted him as their leader.
In his locality.
In his locality. Because you have to remember that, you know, at that time, the tribes were still tribes and they had their own leaders. Mm-hmm. So, but you have to remember, he's in the center. He's literally in the middle, in the heart of the land. And he's in a very, very important city, which means he had some kind of control. This was mm-hmm. this was a very, very important center municipality in the ancient Israelite world. And this is why when the anointed kings, Rehavam, when he goes to Shechem to become king.
Mm.
Because that's the original center.
Fair enough. Now, verse 23, God sent, and now this is what I've got. I want you to tell me what you've got, but this is what I've got in the English. It says, God sent a spirit of ill will between Avimelech and the men of Shechem. What have you got?
Oh, it says Ruach Ra'ah. Ruach Ra'ah is very similar to the idea what we had with Saul.
Mm-hmm.
It's just content. There's no real reason for it to happen. It's just God deciding to put ill content in between the people, ill will in between the people, and there's no reason for it. Just do it. And
so with Shaul, what I've got is a distressing spirit. This is what I've got in the English. They use a different term. It's distressing spirit. Is it the same word?
If I remember correctly, it is. Let me flip through. Do you remember what chapter it is exactly?
First Samuel 16. In fact, it's used a lot. First Samuel 16, verse 14, 15, 16, and 23. It makes reference to this distressing spirit. First Samuel 16, 14. But the spirit of the Lord departed from Shaul, and a distressing spirit from the Lord troubled him.
So here it says Ruach Elohim Ra'ah. It's the same thing.
It's the same thing. So how would you literally translate that?
Just bad mood.
Bad mood. Bad spirit. Bad spirit.
You know, it's basically, you know, the word Ruach represents spirit, and it can also represent the mood of people. And I think this is what's going on here. He's just there's ill spirit in between them, but this is God sent. This is not nothing really happened. There was mm-hmm. no reason for this to happen, but they just started having content towards the person. And, he might have done something very, very simple, something kind of silly maybe. And there was something triggered this ill content towards him.
And it just festered.
And it just festered, exactly. It just happened.
Didn't go away. God sent a spirit of ill will between Abimelech and the men of Shechem. And the men of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech, that the crime done to the 70 sons of Yerubbaal might be settled and their blood be laid on Abimelech, their brother, who killed them, and on the men of Shechem who aided him in killing in the killing of his brothers. And the men of Shechem set men in ambush against him on the tops of the mountains, and they robbed all who passed by them along the way, and it was told to Abimelech. Now Gaal, the son of Ebed, came with his brothers.
What a horrible name.
Gaal, what does Gaal mean?
Gaal is written with an I, and it just sounds like the word Magil, which basically means disgusting or horrible. And he's Gaal, son of slave.
Oh, really? You know? So Eved is slave. So Gaal, the son of Eved.
It's not Eved, it's Eved, by the way. And by the way, it could be that Gaal is some weird Canaanite name that we don't know what it means. It has different meaning in Canaanite, and though Canaanite and Hebrew are close related. But Eved might be some kind of shortened form of Ovadiah or Evedel or something. But they deliberately, and the Bible does it sometimes, they play around with someone's name to mock them. So his name was Gaal, he's a horrible man, son of slave, just mocking him. Maybe. It might be his real name also. You know, it's just trying to understand his weird name.
Just pronounce, now I've got in the English Ebed, but pronounce it again for me.
So it's pronounced Ivid. But again, you have to remember, the English is based on a Greek transmission of these names. And there was a period in time where, for example, the consonants of what's called Beged Kefet, the sound B-G-B-G-D-K-P-T in Hebrew, didn't necessarily have double sounds. There's a thing constant called Beged Kefet. Anyone who's studied Hebrew knows this. They're double-sounded consonants, but it developed somewhere along the line. And this is why, for example, names like Abraham, Ebed, Caleb, you know, Caleb, when you have the bur sound, in many cases in Hebrew, it's a ver sound, but that's because of the layer of history that the Hebrew we have the Masoretic text was in. Not the consonant level, because the consonants were probably very close to one another, but how you actually vocalize it. So there's this whole funny thing going on lately. For example, how do you vocalize a vav? You know, there's two traditions, either as a w or as a v, and essentially this is probably dependent on several things. One of them would be the influence of the country people were living in. Second of all, for example, this claim, Jews who lived in Arabian countries pronounced it as wa. That's actually not correct. And Jews who lived in European countries pronounced it as v. it's actually not correct. Because, for example, German Jews have a tradition that in certain cases the vav is a wa. Mm-hmm. And Moroccan Jews have a very similar tradition as well. North African Jews, for example, almost all of them pronounce the vav as a v. Well, on the other hand, Yemeni Jews vocalize it as a W. Iraqi Jews vocalize it as a W. In Europe, we find cases where it was pronounced as a W. It's more, even more interesting. There's a book from the 1700s, I think, from Frankfurt, where mm-hmm. there's actually information there that hints that European Jews had a very similar vocalization of consonants to the vocalization of North African, of Iraqi Jews and Persian Jews. So I personally think the difference is very, very simple. It depends where the vocalization tradition came from. Was it from the land of Israel or was it from Spain? And that I personally think that's the real difference. If it was from the land of Israel, from the area of Syria, Lebanon, Israel, they vocalized it as wa. And if it came from Spain, it was va. And that's one of the sources of this discussion. Also, for example, the kamats, which is usually vocalized as an a. A lot of European Jews and Yemeni Jews have it pronounced as O. This has to do with the traditions of the Masoretes. They vocalize the kamats as an O all the mm-hmm. time. So it's not cut and clean exactly. You know, it might be this, it might be that. I'm not 100% sure. There's also the discussion, how do you vocalize the name of God? Is it wa? Is it va? And, you know, I would say something very, very simple. I think they're accents. And mm-hmm. if you pronounce it as wa or va, it doesn't really matter. Because this is an issue of accents, and that's how languages work. If you actually study linguistics, you'll know this as a fact. I mean, I'm planning on becoming a student of linguistics hopefully very, very soon, and I'm already reading a lot of material before I go into the university. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I kept on learning was that it really depends on things like this. But specifically here, because of the tradition of the vocalization, each person wrote whatever they wanted to write. So, for example, you have a book from Spain that says it's a V. And you have a book from Iraq, from even earlier, from I think the 9th or 10th century, that says it tells you it's a wa, you know, and it just really depends on the region, really depends on the accent. There are influences, you know. European Jews stopped pronouncing wa, also because of Yiddish that doesn't have a wa. It's based on German, and any wa in English is a v in German. There's multiple possibilities, and this is what linguists do. They go into this different layers. So, for example, I just finished reading one of the books I'm reading at the moment is actually specifically just literally 2 days ago I read about this, and he says that it could be that the difference between b and v developed around the 3rd century BC, which is more or less the time when the Septuagint was written. So the mm-hmm. original Septuagint was written. So when they were trying to create an equivalent of certain sounds in Hebrew, specifically with names, they had difficulty transmitting the actual name. So they wrote it one way, it was vocalized another way, it was vocalized this way, and they wrote it something very similar. And there's a whole list of things. There's different consonants. You know, I think the person who opened up the subject to me was actually Nehemiah. But I developed it even more and more. I started reading more and more material, and there's different things. For example, why is Gaza called Gaza when it's actually with an ayin in Hebrew, which is a l? And this was actually one of the examples Nehemiah gave me eons ago. Mm-hmm. That really there's two sounds for the ayin. One was a l, the other one was a r. And there's places, for example, in the Greek translations where they don't even translate the l sound because it doesn't exist. The guttural A sound, it doesn't exist in Greek, so they just omitted it. For example, Jeroboam, mm-hmm. there's no, it's actually vocalized in Hebrew, Yerovam, but they, you know, it was difficulty, so they're skipping the A sound sometimes. And on the other hand, when it was a R, it was very similar to G, it was very similar to Gamma, and they literally always wrote the Gamma in a certain way. And that's why we have Gaza, where we, it's vocalized in Arabic, Gaza. And they go into this whole discussion about a lot of names of places and names of people that actually give us kind of a hint historically what happened with the language. So the mm-hmm. fact that I have Evid and you have Ebid has to do probably with the history of layers of how words were vocalized. So it might be that when this was written, people did vocalize as Ebid. There was no V sound for the Bet. Masoretes later on have Evid because of what carried on in the language. This is how languages work. But I've seen people, for example, who write, for example, they're trying to write original Hebrew, and they're using diphthongs of, you know, our things are down. They're actually making the Hebrew doesn't even sound any more like the Hebrew that we recognize, and it's only theoretical. Linguistics is sometimes very theoretical, and the fact that someone found that there's a diphthong sometimes where there's a transmission of this sound to that sound, we don't have that in the text we have in front of us. We don't even know if it was different. And on the consonant level, this is the text that we have. If they vocalize it differently, you know, if you want to go vocalize something which you theoretically think is the original vocalization, you know, knock yourself out. I'm very pro that. I studied different accents and tried to dig down deep into the original accent of Hebrew. But when I started studying linguistics, you know, I kind of realized it might be, it might not be. It doesn't really matter. This is how mm-hmm. we vocalize it now. God willing, it might be a revelation of how it was originally vocalized.
Amen. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is why I keep telling you HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com so that the Levite in the Judean desert can give you Hebrew lessons. I'm telling you, Yoel, everyone who is learning Hebrew, all the Hebrew enthusiasts out there are just beside themselves with excitement right now after what you've just given them. That's just a taster, ladies and gentlemen. That is just a taster. HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com is the email address where you can write to Yoel and see if you can fit into his busy schedule. It's certainly worth doing it. I highly recommend it. Thank you for that, my friend. Now, in any case, Gaal, what does he do? Tell us what he does. Who is this guy?
He's an anarchist. He's causing a lot of trouble. He runs around and he basically says, who is Avimelech? You know, the sentence here actually is, who is Avimelech and who is Shem? So we worship Kinavdeno, so we worship Avimelech. So the Navdenu has a suffix that relates back to Avimelech himself. But this is kind of like a sentence. I think the sentence is kind of tricky. It can mean, who is Avimelech that he reigns upon us, and who is Shem so that we worship him, or we enslave ourselves to him. Mm-hmm. This is what's called kind of like a parallel. It's not exactly complete, so we can call it an incomplete parallel, but it's not even 100% parallel. So who is Avimelech? What about Avimelech? Mm-hmm. And who is Shem? So the verb Na'avdeno is related to Avimelech and Shem. Na'avdeno means enslave ourselves to him. For he is Yerubal, Uzvul, his Pakid. So a Pakid is by the Akkadian word, which means a clerk. And they're probably hinting here like he's a foreigner. Now, in the beginning he goes, you are my brothers, because his mother was from Shem. And now Gaal is turning around and says, he's a foreigner. He's the son of Yerubal. And he's basically trying to get people like he's not worth it. He's not really a king for us. He's really our enemy. He's causing more trouble than it's worth it. And you know, this is why it mentions that he reigned as a tyrant over them, mm-hmm. and not she as a king. So he's trying to turn everyone against him. And he says to them, go work for the sons of Chamo, father of Shem. So Chamo, by the way, is donkey in Hebrew. And it's kind of funny. If you go back to Genesis, it talks about Chamo and Shem, his son. And he's basically saying, let's go back to the original leaders of this city, which were Canaanites called Chamo and Shem. Let's go back to the original family.
Let's go back to our roots, right? Let's go back to the roots of our being, is what he's saying.
And now he's saying the next thing. This is saying, who are they? We should go back. And then he says, you know what? I have a better idea. Who will give that this nation will be in my hands? Now he's telling really what he wants. He wants to be king.
That's what he wants. And when Zebul, the ruler of the city, heard the words of Gaal, he was kind of ticked off, right?
Yeah, because you know he works for Avimelech, and he's hearing this nasty behavior towards his boss. Mm. He's like, what are you talking about? You know, we've been here for quite a while. You know, what do you want? You know, and he just runs out, and he finds a way of sending the information. He sends a messengers to Avimelech. So he uses the word malachim, as mm-hmm. we point out again. The word malach essentially means the root might be melech, the root might be malach, not 100% sure. But yes, there are cases where there are roots that people are not 100% sure what they are, and it happens. And he sends messengers to him. So malach usually means messenger, it means angel. We've said this a couple of things. Mm-hmm, and he mm-hmm. tarma, and he receives it and he tells him exactly what happened. And he says, "V'hinam tzarim et ha'ir alecha." They're sieging the city against you, meaning they're making sure your people and you can't get in.
Yeah, that's what I've got. I've got fortifying the city against you. Now, therefore, get up by night, you and the people who are with you, and lie in wait in the field, and it shall be as soon as the sun rises in the morning that you shall rise early and rush upon the city. And when he and the people who are with him come out against you, you may do with them as you find the opportunity. And so he's kind of the architect of the ambush, if you like.
Yeah, he's the architect of the ambush, telling exactly what to do because he's inside, so he knows what's going on. Mm. Now, he starts using tactics very similar to his father. He tells him to split up to four heads, four groups that which will attack from directions.
Yeah.
And then what happens is that he's still in the city, and he's still the clerk of the city, so he's still running, walking around with the leaders. And they go out to the gates, and Avimelech, the moment he sees them, Avimelech gets up and starts walking toward them. And he says, I see men walking down from this. They say, oh, it's just the shadow. The sun is rising. You're seeing shadows. Mm-hmm. And he says to him again, no, I'm seeing people coming out from a place called Tabul Haaretz, from the belly of the land. Mm-hmm. Basically, he saw them coming down from the mountain, and now they're coming up from the land itself. Now, if you ever look at the area of Shechem, it's actually inside a valley. But one of the cute things I saw was when I was on tour, when I was on Rico Cortez's tour, the last one they did, he took the group to the area of Shechem, and we were driving up to an area called Elon Moreh. So it's the town next to Itamar. If you remember Itamar, unfortunately, there was the horrendous story where the family was murdered, the Fogel family. And we went to Itamar. And there's, by the way, a thing called Friends of Itamar if you want to help the community there. I used to live in the area, and I know the problems they're in. This was not the first case. The Fogel family is the latest one. There was another case 10 years ago where a family was also murdered, and I don't know if that one hit the news. And I remember that case because I was watching the fire, because the house caught on fire. I was standing on my side of the mountains, and I could see the fire on the other side. And I remember one case, this was horrendous. There was one case, I went to the school. There was a school there, and a friend of mine was the principal. And he was standing there, and we saw these two Arab women walking up to a field. There's fields very close by, and they're picking things from the field. They're doing as if they're picking, and they're picking these things. And I call my phone and I say, someone come here quickly, there's something fishy. Mm-hmm. I was the guy who called this one, and I called over a security person and said, listen, send someone down to see what's going on. There's something fishy. He's looking with binoculars. I'm looking with binoculars as well, because I actually was in a security car, so I ran. I'm looking and saying, something's wrong here. I'm seeing something. I think I see four people. And so the guy's security guard just ran down, and the order is that they're allowed to open fire when someone gets too close. Mm-hmm. He fired in there, and exactly what I thought I saw. Four men, not two women, four men, two with binoculars, basically looking into the town, trying to figure out how to do something. And this place has been under attack over and over and over again. So we went there to support. There's a thing called Friends of Itamar. It's a very, very important cause. Literally, people in Israel don't understand. People who live, for example, Tel Aviv don't understand. If it wasn't for the people living in Judea and Samaria, the coastal area of Israel will be under attack all the time. Mm. And people, this is the heart of the land, and this is why they're battling us for these areas, is because they know this is where most of the history lies. And they know that if we hold this area as well, we hold it completely, we're in full control of this place. And this is why Israel is called Bamot Olam, high places of the world, because the land was mostly known for its mountains. This is why God says, the land I'm taking you is not a land or a flat land like Egypt. It's actually a land of hills and mountains, and to the rain of the heavens you will drink. And if you know anything about water in this area, there's larger aquifers in the area of Judea and Samaria, bigger than the Kinneret, bigger than the Sea of Galilee. And if you block off the water from the mountains of Judea, you have no water in the coastal plain. And people don't get this. Mm. So we've got most of the water here in Israel is from this area, and people just don't get it. They don't get this into their... Anyhow... the other thing about Tabul Haaretz, the belly button of the land.
Yes.
On the bus, so one of the things that happened, we went on the bus, and there's this funny little mound that has like a rim around. It looks like a belly button. It was really funny. They actually jokingly called this place. Some people might say it's serious, but they jokingly call this place the belly button of the world and of the land. And it literally looks like a people something they call an outie. It was really cute. It's kind of funny when you see it. So they attack him. And they come from a place called Elon Me'onenim. So Me'onen is a type of witchcraft. So Elon Me'onenim might be some kind of tree that they used for witchcraft or guessing creatures and stuff like that. And he battles them, and he God exits from Shechem, and they go into a fight. You can read it by yourself.
And I like the way that finally Zebul, he says to him, "Where indeed is your mouth now?" I like that. Because, you know, you were mouthing off before, but hey, you know, if you still feel brave with which you said, who is Avimelech that we should serve him, are not these the people who you despised? Go out, if you will, and fight with them now. So he had to put his money where his mouth was, so he did. He went out, he took some of the men, and he fought with Avimelech. He went out with some men, and Avimelech chased him, and he fled from him, and many fell wounded to the very entrance of the gate. Then Avimelech dwelt at Arumah.
He doesn't die. He just banishes him from the city.
Yeah.
Something completely loony then happens. He goes into two or three walls. Was it two or three? There's three walls here, and there's no reason. There's no explanation why he's going to this war. But the fire has started, and now he is going completely mad now. So the curse of Yom is actually coming into play.
Yeah.
He's completely loony now. He's attacking everyone he can attack. He's destroying everything. And then on the next day, he goes out to the field. The people go out to the field. He just attacks them, and he splits again to heads. And they destroy, and they go. They block the entrance to the city. Anyone's trying to flee the city, they kill them. So he
destroys the city, and he sows it with salt.
He sows it with salt. So sowing with salt is a symbolic thing. There's a few senses. There's places where they say the king will take salt. And the whole idea is he's not destroying the land. I mean, if you throw salt on the land in massive quantities, you actually will destroy the land. You're drying up the land, and it becomes very salty. But it dries up everything. But essentially, it's probably symbolic. There were different things people did as a symbol. For example, Hadrian, for example, when he conquered Jerusalem, the way of conquering, marking that he is conquered and he is a ruler, was he would ride a chariot with a plowing shear in the back. Plowing shears, I think they're called.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what I mean? The thing that, you know, you put in the land so you turn over the earth.
Oh, like a trowel.
A trowel, yeah, not plowshares. Plowshares is something, it's like a scyther type of thing. Uh-huh. And he would ride a chariot with an ox and a horse, and he'll go around creating a new perimeter, and that was a symbol of controlling it. Another way of saying we have full control and we're destroying was burning everything. So one of the symbolic actions, and this is more symbolic, is taking salt and throwing it, scattering salt, symbolizing the idea of cursing the land that it won't be fertile anymore. So he's going completely wild now. He's just like, everyone's against him. He's going to destroy everyone. And that's the next thing he does. And he goes to the city. He battles against the city. He captures the city. And he kills everyone. And he destroys the city. And he throws the salt. And it just becomes wild. And then the next thing he does, and all the people of Migdal Shechem, the Tower of Shechem, okay? On the Tower of Shechem, they run off to a place called the Tzariach of Shechem. So Tzariach, what does your English say?
I've got here in 46 that all the men of Shechem heard they all headed for the stronghold of the temple of El Berit, the god of the covenant, right? They entered into this temple, and this is the temple out of which they took the 70 shekels to give him so that Avimelech could kill his brothers. And it was told to Avimelech that all the men were in the Tower of Shechem. They were gathered together, and then Avimelech went up to Mount Zalmon. And all the people who were with him, and Avimelech took an axe in his hand and cut down the boughs of a tree, and he took it, he laid it on his shoulders, he said to everyone, hey, do what I'm doing. And so they all went and got the branches of the trees, and they came back, they made a massive fire, which basically cooked the stronghold, and it says so that all the people of the Tower of Shechem died, about 1,000 men and women. I mean, that's a big tower, Yoel.
So the question is, your thing says tower, so I was looking through this before we started the recording, and actually they say the word Tzariach in some Semitic languages actually is a stronghold that's dug in the ground. It's actually in the rock.
Oh, really?
Tower. And it's a possibility. I was, you know, the word Tzariach in Hebrew always, you know, for most of us, means a tower, but here they say that the word Tzariach in some languages actually means a stronghold which is dug inside the rock, and so it's in the bedrock. And the idea is that some people will say he used what the Romans did, which was smoking people.
Right. So he smoked them. Okay. So he suffocated them.
Suffocated them, exactly. And then he goes to a place called Tevez. Now, Tevez has a personal issue with me. Tevez, according to some theories, is a place called Tubas. And Tubas happens to be a village which was under the jurisdiction of my unit. So I actually, when we're talking about this area now, he's actually moving towards the east, more into the mountains of the east of Shem. And that's an area I was in for quite a while. It's a pretty amazing area. And there's actually a base called Tevez, which my unit used to control that base as well. And we had a village called Tubas, which some people say Tevez is Tubas, the same area. There's another theory that claims it's another place. There's a new theory that claims it's another place. I can't remember exactly the name of it. But this section is just very important for me because I know the area. I know exactly what it looks like. I've been there. I spent months in the area, maybe almost a year in the area, every day, except for the days when I had leave to go home. Mm-hmm. So he goes to a place called Tevez, and he captures it. And there's a stronghold, as Keith would say, a Migdal Oz. So
yes.
There's a Migdal stronghold. I just remember because I was there when they did the recording. I don't know if people remember this. There was a video that Keith published when he was promoting his Hallowed Name Revealed Again. And he was there together with Nehemiah. It was really funny. They were sitting on this rock. We went to this place in the Valley of Elah. And I apparently was a director. I was a film guy, director, everything. And I was standing there holding these things with the text. And every time Keith, you know, goes like, Amigdal Oz. we took so many takes. I mean, I told Keith we had to keep the outtakes because it was just hilarious what was going on.
And then, of course, he's quoting, of course, Proverbs chapter 18, verse 10, which it says, "The name of Yehovah is a strong tower, which is the Migdal Oz. The righteous man runs to it, run into it, and is safe."
So this is the whole idea. They had a Migdal Oz. They had a stronghold, a place of saving inside the city. And they ran to there. And here's the irony. This is the irony of what happens. So first, remember, it's like fire. He's attacking. There's no reason. He's outraged. Outrage is, you know, for example, when the Bible wants to express that someone's angry, you know, he's vengeance and everything. It's also like fire, the energy of fire consuming. And this is what's going on. And then we have a very interesting piece of irony here because he goes to attack the city. He goes to attack this tower. So this is actually a tower. He uses the word Migdal. So Migdal is probably from the word of Gadol, which means big. So it's probably at some kind of tower. Now, when we say towers, we're not talking like towers and, in medieval times in Europe, these things were like 30, 40, 50 feet tall. We're talking about probably something which was maybe 20 feet. Not too sure. I can't really tell you how tall it was. But we're not talking about massive structures. We're talking about big, but not, you know, miles and miles in the air. And the piece of irony here is that he goes towards the opening of the city, the tower, to burn it. He wants to do the same action. So he's using fire again. But then a woman we remember with Yael, a woman picks up a piece of a rock which belongs to the thing where they caught when they turn wheat into flour. What is that thing called?
So the millstone. So I've got a millstone in verse 53. A certain woman dropped an upper millstone.
Mm-hmm. So it's called. It says here in the Hebrew, pelach rechev. So pelach is a piece of something, and rechev. So there's the shechev and rechev. Shechev is from the word shochev, laying down. So that's the piece of rock that's on the ground itself, and then the rechev is a piece that rides on it. So it's from the word rochev, to ride. So he takes a piece and just throws it down and basically smashes his head in. And it does,
but this is what I've got. Oh, my goodness, it's gruesome. It says, "But a certain woman dropped an upper millstone on Abimelech's head and crushed his skull," is what I've got. But Yoel, it's not as if she didn't knock him out. I mean, the guy's still withered enough to realize he's done for. And so he called quickly to the young man, his armor bearer, and said to him, "Draw your sword and kill me, lest they say of me, a woman killed him." And so so the young man thrust him through, and he died.
Yeah, and it says in the last verse, verse 56 says, "And God gave back the evil of Avimelech, which he did to his father to kill his 70 brothers." That's the message. There's a message here. If anyone wants to be king, they have to be righteous.
Yeah.
You want to be king? Yeah, great. Thumbs up. But beware.
Beware. And so that's right. And so God repaid. And so we see, of course, that all of this was orchestrated, that Yotam was right in what he said, And Yehovah, God, repaid the wickedness of Abimelech, which he had done to his father by killing his 70 brothers, and all the evil of the men of Shechem, God returned on their own heads, and on them came the curse of Yotam, the son of Yehobar. Now, the interesting thing, Yotam, interesting thing, Yoel.
Yeah, my name is Yoel. God, so by the way, just very quickly about the name Yotam. Yotam is Yo, is like Yoel. Mm-hmm. So Yo is some kind of abbreviation of the name of God. And Yoel means God, you know, Tetragrammaton is God. Mm-hmm. And Yotam means God is Tam, which means righteous. So there's also an inner meaning here with the name, where basically the tmimut here, the righteous, the word Tam is unblemished as well, means God doesn't keep things left open. If he has to finish something off, he does. So there's an interesting, again, the names come into play here, and they're like, they have a better, more of this, the meaning of what they are. It's, again, the discussion of, are these names the original names, or are these names were given because of the story, or are the names just a coincidence that they're called this, and it came out to be that name had an extra meaning to the story. But it doesn't matter. What we have here with Yotam's name is that God is righteous, and he if he has to act in a certain way to keep the righteousness in the world, he does that. And this is the message of the name here.
And it's a fine name. And g'day to anybody out there whose name is Yotam. How's that?
And there is one who knows specifically who he is.
That's right. And now, the other thing, I told him
I'll mention him without telling who he is. So I just did that.
We snuck it in there. The son of Yerubbaal. Now, it's interesting. I just wanted to say that it's just a curious thing that Gideon is referred to as Yerubbaal for the majority of this story.
He mostly appears as Yerubbaal, which is interesting. It's an interesting way it's done. I actually don't really know.
Anyhow, that concludes chapter 9. Hey, we did it. We got all the way through.
And you thought it's going to be a quick one. We just did over an hour of the chapter.
Yeah, but we did it in the allocated space of time that we said. We made it. We did it pretty well. But next week, we're going to be in chapter 10, and it begins with
Tola ben Puah. Yeah, it's an interesting name.
And then
we'll go over that next week.
And we'll Jephthah. If we can get through the whole story of Jephthah, I would be in Jephthah. Actually, Jephthah. Jephthah, right?
Yiftach.
Yiftach.
Okay. I actually have a student call himself Yiftach. So, Yiftach, if you're hearing this, I'm sending you a hello from Israel.
There you go. Shout out to him. And we'll try and get through that whole story next week. But you have been listening to Light of the Prophets. And thank you, Yoel Ben Shlomo. His Facebook page is Hebrew in Israel. And if you would like Hebrew lessons from the Levite in the desert of Judea, you can inquire. Once again, HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. And if these programs have been a blessing to you, you can also show your support by donating at truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org. And next week, kicking off from chapter 10. Till then, dear listeners, be blessed, be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom kol tov from the heat of the desert.
How hot is it, by the way? How hot?
It's pretty hot. The wind just started blowing a bit, so it's cooler now. But yeah, it's stinking out.